Good afternoon, everyone. I always begin with the prayer to the Holy Spirit. I always begin all my lessons invoking His presence. It's very important. So, the first citation is from Castico Nubi, 69. Castico Nubi was an encyclical written by Pius XI in 1930. And the encyclical, there's a number 69, says, "Men are begotten not for the earth and for time, but for heaven and eternity." Men are begotten not for earth and for time, but for heaven and eternity. And then this is one of the examples that permeates this great encyclical. Another one that I use with my students is this one. It comes from number 13, Castico Nubi 13. Listen to this. "But Christian parents must also understand that they are destined not only to propagate and preserve the human race on earth." Indeed, not only to educate and any kind of worshippers of the true God, but children who are to become members of the Church of Christ, to raise up fellow citizens of the saints, members of God's household, worshippers of God and our Savior, may daily increase. So notice the supernatural outlook of this. I mean, when I teach my students, I basically summarize it. You are to create worshippers of God. It's a different approach. It's a higher approach to looking at procreation. We're not, like we talked about today, we're not creating rabbits. We're creating worshippers of God. We're not looking at human beings merely from a point of view that is material, empirical, physical, body. But we're looking at human beings from the hylomorphic structure of man. Man as body and soul. You know, you're looking at the spirit. And that's what's happening here. So note it, that's important to note that that's the approach. It's procreation, not reproduction. To create with God. God gives us the gift of participating in His creation with our will and our intellects. This is really important. We're not just kind of, you know, a dog that sees the other dog and then, boom, that happens. No, no, you're thinking about it. You're willing it. These are the foundations. Because, you know, see, God has an intellect, has a will Himself. The angels have intellects and wills, but they're just spiritual creatures. We have intellect and wills as well, but we all have the body on top of it. And then you have like animals that don't have the rational souls, who can think and who can rationally decide and make moral choices. And then you've got vegetables, you've got the vegetative souls, like the plants that don't even, they're just pure appetite moving towards the light, okay? Yeah. That's okay. So, man has this great honor of participating in the creation of man by God. Man was created by God in His image and likeness. And God wants this to take place, this whole thing has to take place in a family. The most basic social unit of the society and the most basic social unit of the highest of societies, the church. So there's a hierarchy even in the societies we're dealing with. Everything's hierarchical. Everything's structured. And that's the thinking of the church. When we read such documents, we always see hierarchical structure. We always see an order in the way we think. First you think of God, then you think of His creation. And it's not just disordered, like today. Everything's sort of, you throw everything around like you kind of create a salad, you know? No, it's not like that. You have to have everything within a structured order. And it is such order that the church seeks to protect over the centuries. The church seeks to protect the order of the family. And we read these encyclicals from Benedict XIV in the 1740s to Gregory XVI in the 1830s to Leo XIII in the 1890s. And Leo XIII writes this encyclical called Arcanum Divinum Sapientia. Divine Sapientia. Arcanum Divine Sapientia. Which talks about the arcane, the mystery of the divine wisdom. The title itself, mystery, the arcanum, is that which is the mystery, actually, of the divine wisdom. And that encyclical is written
in 1890. No, excuse me, 1880, 50 years prior to Castigo Nubi. So there's a movement in this. And that encyclical deals with protecting the contract, the marriage contract, in light of divorce. Okay? Earlier encyclicals by Benedict XV, 14th, and so forth, they deal with protecting the marriage within Catholic marriage. So not mixing the marriages in Albania and different places. I've always been worried, the popes have always been worried about marriage. Obviously. Right? And then in the 1930, what is the issue? The issue is the Lambeth Conference in England, right? Where for the first time contraception is permitted in a Christian setting. First time. Calvin, Luther, everyone was against this. 1928, I think it was the Council of Lambeth, 1928, permitted contraception. And the church responded. Pius XI responded no to this. So this is the link then that will link to Humanae Vitae, because the battle is beginning in this period, like right now, right in 1930. The church's position against contraception has its biblical basis. You know, at one point we read in Genesis that Onan lay with Tamar, but he did not want her to become pregnant. Therefore, he spilled the seed on the ground. This act was evil in the eyes of God, and he took his life. God took his life. Took Onan's life. So Onanism, the Cetus Interruptus is called, was one of the several methods which aimed at enjoying sexual relations while avoiding conception. So notice, what it's doing is it's aiming at the second end of, which is the unitive end, and avoiding the procreative end, the two ends of marriage, right? This is the language that you read. It's very Thomistic language, again, hierarchical language. First end of marriage, to have children. The second end of marriage, to be united in one, to be together, the unitive end. Okay, these two ends are very important throughout the thinking that goes on here. But then we'll move into this. After creating us male and female, God gave the first command, be fertile and multiply. That's the first end. That's the first end of marriage, be fertile and multiply. How do you do that? Through the sexual act. How is the sexual act? Well, you have to have a unity. You can't have the sexual act without unity. You have to unite two to make one sexual act, you know. And so they work together. And right now we call that the whole conjugal act, the conjugal act, right? The whole part. It's the conjugal act that has to have both parts. In the following chapter, you know, where after he says, be fertile and multiply, the Creator gives the other motive for marrying. He says, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So the two coming together. That the two shall become one is intimately tied to the first end of marriage, procreation. It is for this reason that Pope Pius XI stressed that it is never licit to use artificial methods, and that the natural methods should only be used with the strict limitations, he says. He writes in number 54, by no reason, however grave, may be put forward by which anything intrinsically against nature may become conformable to nature and morally good. So you can't change. St. Thomas gets into this in one question. I didn't write this in the text. In the Prima Secunda, question 88, article 6, St. Thomas Aquinas says, is it possible to change a mortal sin into a venial sin? Answer, no. And then you can ask yourself, but you should know. What if you don't know? You should know, he says. And in another question, Prima Secunda, question 19, article 6, way before, he says, you should know. And that's the question that deals with the article before on conscience. So you should know. Okay, but then you'll ask, well, how are people supposed to know in a society like the one we live in? That's where it gets complicated. That's where it gets really complicated. Because yes, you should know, but people today, there is a sense of what is called invincible ignorance. But that's a side question. It's an important question. No? St. Thomas then also says at another point, the culpability. Culpability of infidelity, of being unfaithful to the faith, to what you should know. In the Secundus, question 10, article 6, he says, those who are most culpable are those who are the apostates and heretics first, then the Jews, then the pagans. Why? Because those who are closest to Jesus should know better. So, if you know better, you're going to be more culpable. And if you're not teaching it, you're going to be more culpable for not teaching it. So guess what? You're trapped. Because you should know better now.
Oh, sorry, it's for...
Yeah. So, you see, when you know, then you've got to face what you know. Mm. So, there's a lot of culpability going on with people who don't, who ignore what needs to be taught. Gaudium et Spes 48, Gaudium et Spes 50 reiterates the same teaching. By their very nature, the institution of matrimony itself and conjugal love are ordained for the procreation and education of children and find in them their ultimate crown. Notice this, procreation and education. You have to educate your children. It's not just having children, it's educating them. And every pope talks about this too. You're having them and you have the responsibility of teaching them. And that shows you that that's why it's a spiritual fatherhood and motherhood. Which, why is it spiritual? Because it's related to forming the intellect and the will of your children who are in the image of God. Right? They're not, and you're trying to make them like God. You're trying to make them not sin, to make them like God. Because we lose our likeness to God. Original sin, right? So, as we know, the great majority of Catholics followed this teaching up to the 1950s. Then what happens? The pill comes along. And the pill makes things easier. And it makes things more difficult for Catholics. Because they've got this teaching, but they've got this pill. They got temptation coming along. And I'll get into that too eventually. And you get this, and you get all this, you know, this capsule, this pill. Is presented as the solution to almost all world problems: overpopulation, undesired pregnancies, abortion, child abuse, poverty associated with large families, even marital stress. Everything, this pill is going to solve it all. It's the panacea. That's how it's sold. In other words, the pill advocates use the language of the two ends of marriage as well. However, they claimed that by controlling the procreative end, controlling it, one would find peace in the unitive end. So you control the procreative end, and you're going to be fine. You're going to be happy with your wife because you've locked that. So you've got all that nuisance, all those children, that nuisance aside, and you're going to have fun now. And that's basically what it's saying. That's what they, how they sell the product. This would strengthen couples, they claimed. Finally, they would be able to enjoy each without the burden of children. The sexual revolution was gaining ground everywhere. And the proud boast of the Student Solidarity publication from Chicago was, "It isn't easy to be Catholic." Sex was no longer mainly for procreation, but for pleasure. And the consequences would soon be demographic crisis, abortion, child abuse, poverty, abandonment of the elderly and euthanasia, divorce, broken homes, etc., etc. Unprecedented numbers of divorces, everything. So we know, we're living in a time after this. What's interesting about all these encyclicals, by the way, is that when you read them, and you read what the popes are saying in the 1930s, you're like, well, you know, but this isn't happening. You know, what's this Pope talking about? I mean, everything's fine. 1930s, imagine 1930s. Mm-hmm. We're not living in 2015 or whatever. It's 1930. And the Pope is, they're talking like very seriously. Because they see that this is going to happen. And the thing, the vantage point that we have, unfortunately, is that we're seeing the consequences. Mm-hmm. That they didn't, they saw, they foresaw them, but they didn't live them. We lived them. So then we have an advantage of saying, well, they were right. There's connections. Like today's talk, it was very good. I thought Professor Vini's talk was really good. Like the examples he used. We have examples. We have reason to believe that we're right. So why are they still screaming? Well, there's articles about this, about what's going on in the world today. So-called liberals are not really liberals. They're not liberal thinking. Because if you don't think like they think, then they persecute you, you know. And there's an interesting article that I read last week. And this site is called MercatorNet. It stems from Australia. There was a really good article on this, talking about the alt-left. I think it was written by a professor from James Shaw wrote it. James Shaw. It's a very good article showing this. Anyway, so you see the consequences. Paul VI talks about it. We've been going over it. In Humane Vitae, number 17. Increase in infidelity, general lowering of morality. We've been going over this. A loss of respect, objectification of women. The governments would coerce their populations to use contraception if they felt it furthered the good of the state. So here's another problem. You have this is typical of ideologies of totalitarianism, that the common good suffocates the individual good. You know, but in a Catholic mindset, we have two principles, individuation and participation. The individual and the participate in the common good. Both work hand in hand, right? They both work hand in hand. You don't suffocate the individual for the good of the community, and you don't suffocate the community for the good of the individual. There's a harmony that has to exist between the two. You always have to look, and the Catholic approach is always both and. It's never just categorically this or that. Whenever you hear categorical things where it's just one thing being boasted about among another, be suspicious. Okay? Be suspicious of those things. We see the results today. I mean, I could go into this a lot more, but we see the results of the demographic problems and the economic problems that results because of that. There's books written on all this. Ettore Gotti Tedeschi, who was the president of IOR, the bank at the Vatican, he wrote a book recently on this, on the economic consequences of demographic fall. I mean, it's obvious. Fewer people working in the workforce, you're going to have economic consequences, especially for an economy that's based on consumerism. So it's the dog biting its own tail, right? And then, okay. Back when the pill came out, with so many apparent advantages, there was enormous pressure to change church teaching. The same old lies were spread. We must enter the modern era and accept this new technology as a true building, blessing from God. While one could see this with improved transportation technology that facilitated one's movements, one could not apply the same reasoning to marriage. We have to understand, you know, technology itself, if you think of technology, one thing I always tell students, technology is not bad in and of itself. No. It's how you use technology, though. Don't let technology use you, but you use technology. Right? That's the key concept here. So just because you have a means to do something doesn't mean you need to use it. I mean, you can find a technology to kill someone. Does that mean you need to use that? You know, a better way to kill someone? No, it doesn't mean. I mean, this is obvious, you know. So when people say, oh, get in with the times and technology is moving us ahead, don't buy that either. Don't necessarily buy that. Dostoevsky, this is really interesting. When he criticizes Nietzsche at one point, he says that atheism has three parts to it. Atheism has, the first part of atheism is pride. The second part is irresponsibility. And the third part is progress. Interesting, the third part is progress. You'd think pride makes sense, that would be at the basis of atheism, because you're proud, so you're going against God. Right? It makes sense. So the antidote is humility, truth, and all that, right? Obviously, that's the antidote. Irresponsibility. What's the antidote to irresponsibility? Fatherhood, motherhood, family. Notice how this is tied to atheism. You attack the family, and you tie it into atheism. It's connected.
you attack the family by attacking responsibility, by attacking maturity, by not enforcing that the person needs to be mature. You know, a big problem with homosexuality is immaturity. It's the Peter Pan syndrome. A lot of that is that. You see this a lot. People don't want to take their responsibilities. They don't want to pick up their own crosses. So the third one, progress. How do you attack progress? Well, progress is doing is what? Progress is progress towards an end you don't even know. So everyone's always talking about progress, progress, progress. Progress to what? My question. Progress to what? You move towards something where you know where you're going. So you attack progress by doing what? By being tied to tradition. By being tied to your past, to your identity. So, you know, there are a lot of scholars today who talk about this, actually. Eliminating historical identity. Keith Windschuttle, he writes a book, he's an Australian, and his book is called The Killing of History. The Killing of History. So you kill your history, you kill your identity, and before you know it, you've got a bunch of tribes. Well, that's what we've got today. We've got a lot of tribes, a lot of groups. We're killing civilization. We're killing identity. We're killing our history. We're killing who we are, where we come from, and where we're going. So if you want to recapture that, you have to recapture identity, who you are. We have a crisis of identity because we have a crisis in the family. You see how it's all connected? It's not just, you're not just dreaming this up. And then, Richard Weaver, he was a professor at the University of Chicago in the 1950s. He wrote a lot of good books. Ideas of Consequences is one of them. And his last book, published posthumously, was called Visions of Order. And in this book, he talks about this. The loss of identity through our loss of history. Things are not connected. Moral acts are not connected. Things are not connected to each other. People are not connected to each other. Generations are not connected to generations. Everything's disconnected. This is having an effect. So you see how you can connect a lot of these thinkers, Richard Weaver, Keith Windschuttle, Dostoevsky, lots of thinkers, and you see that they're all kind of connecting the dots. You want atheism? Kill the family. Kill history. Kill identity. You want to kill the family? Get to this. You know? Eliminate the first end of marriage. Eliminate procreation. Make sex fun. Make sex just about pleasure. What's the difference between joy and pleasure? It's a fun question to ask. What's the difference? Everyone seeks pleasure, but pleasure is passing. Joy comes as a result of a cross. There's a difference between joy and pleasure. One is, joy is rooted in an intellect. Joy is not rooted in the senses. It's rooted in the higher faculties. It's more ordered. Okay? So, are there any questions? No? Comments? Is everyone following me?
Yes.
Is this making sense? Okay.
So, all right, so notwithstanding, there's a linguistic difference between Kastiko Nubi and Umane Vite. There's a linguistic difference. Because Kastiko Nubi talks about first and second end. Umane Vite talks about the conjugal act. The conjugal act. It doesn't talk about them in the first and secondary order like that. Okay, it doesn't put it that way. Notwithstanding this, Paul VI had foreseen what was not far ahead. So he was seeing this. So notwithstanding the difference in the language, one is more Thomistic and the other is more personalist, let's say. Notwithstanding, they're both focusing on the fact that there's going to be a Pandora's, the Pandora's box has been opened, where human life itself is devalued, cheapened, even redefined, much like what we read in Aldous Huxley. In the book, the novel, Brave New World, right? In this deterministic world, in Brave New World, in which people are manipulated already in their embryonic phase. There are strict class structures. Notice what's happening here. It's a dictatorship. This is Titus. Strict class structures is basically enslave everyone. For instance, we read what Mr. Foster says towards the beginning of the novel. We all predestined and conditioned. We decant our babies as socialized human beings, as alphas or epsilons, as future sewage workers or future, he was going to say, future world controllers, but correcting himself, said future directors and hatcheries instead. You see what's happening? But it's happening now. IVF. You know this is happening. I mean, people in Mexico, for instance, now, where it's legalized, where IVF is legalized, you'll have some rich Texans or whatever going down, and if they want a baby girl or a baby boy, okay, $1,000, whatever. But I want that baby boy, baby girl. I want a baby boy, but I want that baby boy to have blonde hair. Oh, okay, that'll cost you $2,500. No, but I want some blue eyes too. Oh, $3,000. And then I want them to be this tall or that or whatever. And the price keeps going up to specialize what kind you want. That's what's happening. This is what's happening. I know. It's happening. And what is also happening is that what's going to happen? What's happening is that you're separating the procreation from the sexual act. You do it all in a petri dish. Separation, not distinction of the two. That's a key thing. So when I talk about the distinction between Umane Vitae and Casti Connubi, both Casti Connubi and Umane Vitae talk about the two ends not being separate. You can distinguish the two ends, rationally distinguish. You're having sex, the unitive, which is unitive in itself. For what reason? To have children. Okay, that's a rational distinction between the two ends. But if you separate it, if you separate the two ends, then you've got a problem. If sex is all about just pleasure, then you're going to get gay marriage. Who wants to stop it? And you see this, you know, in Justice Kennedy, who's now retiring, when he did his thing in the Obergefell case in June 26, 2015, when he made his defense of it, what did he say? This will enrich in marriage. So-called gay marriage is going to enrich in marriage. Why is it going to enrich in marriage? Because it's going to make more people be able to be united to each other. So it's focusing on the second end, or only the second end. Because obviously they can't procreate. That sex doesn't procreate, obviously. It's just pleasure. And it's not really doesn't have much to do with joy in the end either. But that's another issue. So what happens? They are looking for in vitro fertilization. So you'll have like big time stars now, gay, like Elton John, for instance, purchasing a baby. Two, maybe three, I don't know, whatever. What color, whatever, what height, chooses everything. I mean, so it's not like Brave New World is coming alive. What are we supposed to do in the middle of this? Well, I don't know. That's another issue. C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man. I mean, all these people, all these authors, I mean, these are philosophers, these are writers, they're all talking about this. He also foresaw the gradual coarsening of societal ethics to the point where the person is degraded and cheapened beyond recognition. That's what's happening here. Transhumanism is coming along. I teach a whole course on this. From transgender to transhumanism. From the Imago Dei to the death of the image of God. There's a whole course on this topic I teach. It's true, it's what's happening. We're going beyond man. Man, whatever. We don't like man anymore. And we like nature. So now you got the whole, you know, we're going to put the animals before man. That's happening right now too. You see how it's all connected though. I'm just trying to show you, these things are all connected. You take away ideas of consequences, that title by Richard Weaver. You take away one thing and it's going to have these enormous consequences that you don't even realize. You take away the idea of the conjugal act of marriage is supposed to be this way, the way God has foreseen it, and the church has, and Christ has then announced publicly, very explicitly, and the way the church has only defended and explained throughout the centuries,
Well, that maintains society. You get rid of all that, you get rid of one, that one part, and you have this result. A society that's in shambles. People that do not have a sense of who they are as people, as man and woman. The whole transgender thing is a confusion in their identity. There's a psychological thing going on there. There's a spiritual thing going on there. It's a tragedy. It's terrible. It's very difficult. You know, I deal with some people who have these complexities, let's say. It's sin. It's the result of sin. There's this show on Netflix, it's called Black Mirror. If anything, if you have it on Netflix, if you should watch it, watch this show. And it's very dramatic. It shows the extreme consequences of immorality. Black Mirror. Because it's the negative, it's the black image of the mirror that you have. The negative consequences. In the fourth season, there is an episode that shows this man trying to, I mean, it's all sci-fi, but behind sci-fi, there's ideology too. So he's living in a bad situation in his office. So what does he do? He creates these, from the cells that people leave behind in the coffee cup or whatever, he creates their character in another world, an alternative world. He creates his own alternative world. And he goes into this. But the big problem you see at the end, I'm not going to tell you the ending. But you see, there's a tear in the end, basically, in him that comes down his eye, you know? He's using technology completely immorally. But what's the problem? He's not going to resolve the big problem. The big problem is a crisis in his soul. A crisis in the soul that he can only resolve by turning to God. You see what I'm saying? Not by these secondary means. Okay? Is this making any sense? Is it worth talking about? Okay. So it's all connected. That you've got what C.S. Lewis calls the men without chests. Because he talks about an individual made up of head, the intellect, the chest, the spirit of the heart, and the stomach, the good and instinctive desires. So you've got, you know, so all you've got are men with stomachs. Without heads, without chests, just stomachs. That's what you've got today. A lot of men with stomachs. A lot of stomachs running around. Heads and chests, out of the way. And you have some chest issue, if you have a heart, you're going to suffer in this society. And you're going to suffer the loneliness of being in a society full of men without chests. Because that's where we're living. I don't know if you feel it, but I certainly do. As a priest, you can imagine. I was in Paris a couple of weeks ago, and I was at the Sacré-Cœur, and then my friend goes, oh, you know, let's go and visit, let's just go down and see the Moulin Rouge. I'm like, Moulin Rouge? Oh, yeah, and I heard the music, the musical. I didn't know it was about a prostitute and love and falling in love with her. I didn't know. I was dumb about that. I thought, oh, I like the music. It's sounded nice. So I'm walking down like this, cassock and everything, you know, obviously. Down the road to go, and my friend is with me, and I started looking at him, we started looking at each other, and he's like laughing. Yeah, he laughed at me, because he wasn't a priest, so I'm like, and I felt very uncomfortable, because I'm going through, and everything was porn shops down the whole road. Oh, I was like, oh. So you can imagine, you know, in this sign of contradiction walking through this, because I was like, well, I mean, basically you feel like a sign of contradiction as a priest. But even you, I can imagine you feel that way in your workforce and all that, and where you work, where you are in the world. I imagine also how I feel sometimes in the world that we live in, going in like this. I don't even notice it anymore, but there I noticed it. Because there I really was like, but generally I don't even notice anymore the contrast. But it's there, and it's constant. But you're not alone. You're not alone. You have God. That's the important thing to keep reminding yourselves. Keep your chests to yourselves. Keep your chest. Keep nourishing that chest. And keep nourishing, above all, that intellect, that head. Keep nourishing that head to nourish that chest. In the act of faith, I teach my students, there's three parts. Notion, motion, emotion. The notion of the faith, which is what you need. You need to have the notion of the faith. The motion of grace, which moves the will,
Because if you don't move the will, you can have all the notions you want, but if you have no love, you're not going to turn to God. You have to have that oomph that moves your chest, that moves your heart to God, that changes your will and turns it to God. And then come the emotions is the last part. Guess what we focus on today too much on? Emotions.
Yeah.
It's all about emotions. Mm-hmm. Nobody's talking about the will and the intellect. Nobody's talking about the notions and emotions of grace. Because even the notions are grace. Because it's God revealing himself to us and giving us the fullness of truth. Nobody's talking about that, even in the church. So, notions, motions, emotions. Last part, emotions. It comes. I'm Italian, I'm emotional. But I'm not just emotional. I'm emotional because of what I study and what I love as a result.
Just when you say church, can you distinguish between different national churches, or are you just saying
in general, it's happening all over the world. Okay. Yeah, I live in Rome, so I just look at the church in general. I look at what's going on. And unfortunately, there's a lot of emotion going on. Yeah.
Can I just ask about homosexuality? You seem to be saying that it comes from lack. Is the jury still out on that? I mean, is that definitive? You know, we get a lot here anyway about from birth, you know.
Okay.
It's not anymore.
Yeah, the position is that it's not, because there's an opposition between born that way or not born that way.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the whole gender movement is that you have Simone de Beauvoir in the 1940s, she was the lover of what's his name? Pardon?
Camus?
No, not Camus, no, Sartre. She was Sartre's lover.
What's her name?
Simone de Beauvoir, famous. So she says, you're not born a woman, you're become a woman. Okay? She's not the one to coin gender. Gender comes up with Judith Butler. But then, what's interesting, but she's obviously pushing for this. But then what do they say now about gays? You're born that way.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? So whatever, they just kind of change it according to whatever they want.
Is the jury out?
No, the jury's not out. It's always, it's a mystery, and you have to handle case by case. Now, I'll get to you. The thing that you have to remember, there's... Generally, Nicolosi and Ardwig, I teach this section on this. The psychologists, these good psychologists, they talk about this. They say that usually it's connected to the first, it's wounds, it's trauma, some sort of trauma that you have in your early childhood related to your father and the mother and the absence of the father for the men. It's different also between male and female. There's differences in there. And then the secondary thing is how the peers react. So a lot of that has to do with the psychology. It's a bit of a mystery.
Well, the nature and nurture thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery. How much is nature, how much is nurture? There's elements that are nature in the sense that there could be problems in the hormonal development or things like that. There's all sorts of different things that come up. But the main issue to keep with that is that basically what you have to say, what I say in my class, I say, you know, you can't tell me that two people saying, I love you, and then they go sodomize each other. I just say it like that. Mm. I just say, well, that doesn't really sound like something you would do with someone you love. Mm. Does it? And I just leave it at that. Mm. I mean, it doesn't sound that way. It just doesn't sound right. I don't know.
At the end of the Gino project in the UK, a few weeks ago, said that
there's a
gay
gene.
Not found anything wired in. And also noted that among studies
it's
of
true.
Identical twins, that there was only a 9% correspondence, and you would normally expect something more like 58% if it was something genetic.
Yeah, that's right.
So please
good.
That
I'm glad you did that. No. It's true. I've studied similar studies like that. Yeah.
Yes.
Most studies show that it's not. Yeah. Yes.
During the same-sex marriage referendum in Ireland, I worked for several weeks on the streets in Dublin opposing same-sex marriage. The number of doctors of all nationalities who came up to me and to other people who are working to oppose same-sex marriage said, thank God somebody's doing something, they won't let us onto the radio or the television. And they all said the same thing, there is no evidence, either biological or genealogical, to sustain the lie that sexual deviance is inborn and natural. It is not. All acts start in the head.
But didn't they take some...
All right, but there, yes. Let me take this back, sorry. There's a lot, it's a very complicated issue, and I can't go too much into this, but I will quote something on this, actually, that I have here, which gets me to the next point. By an author by the name of Shimon Cowan, Jewish author, that's a Jewish name, I think, in Australia. He wrote a book recently that's titled Homosexuality, Marriage, and Society, and this is a very interesting point. And there's another book in Australia, I forgot the title right now, but I was reading it, and it shows homosexual parenting and the effects, but this is what this is related to. He says, if sexual relationships have to do with a spiritual and ethical mission to propagate generations with full biological identity and ties, then this ethical duty to the next generation means that marriage cannot be simply what a law court or government deems it to be. Instead, marriage must involve some possibility of begetting and raising one's own biological children. Although some marriages between a man and a woman will be infertile, and extrinsic reasons like age, all same-sex unions are intrinsically infertile and require a surrogate to reach the procreative end. What such unions fail to see is that the procreative end is not just about the parents, but about the children and the family unit as a whole. So, and this is not a bishop or a priest, this is just an author writing about this problem. Okay? And that you see the effects of this. I mean, that's what's interesting. When I talk about, you know, transgender, I will cite like some of the feminists from the second generation feminists, the 1970s feminists, who are against transgender because they see that transgender is against women. I cite that in my papers, in my class, to show. And so that's another approach also. You use their arguments to fight their case also. But the difference is, and as Catholics, we come at it from a higher angle. Mm-hmm. We come at it from the theological. You see, there's theological, metaphysical, and empirical knowledge, epistemologically speaking. In the levels of knowledge, theology is the highest because it's God. Metaphysics is the second highest because you've got the fifth philosophy. And empiricism is the third. It's like the facts that we've got here. What happens? In contemporary philosophy, you have Auguste Comte saying, no, it's the reverse. We're moving away from theology, which is called fetishism, towards progress of empiricism. So now they limit knowledge to just what is merely empirical. So that's why you can't enter the discourse from a theological worldview in this worldview, which is completely limited to materialism, to empiricism, to just the cold, hard facts. Okay, with all that behind us, okay, fine. But we're Catholics. So Thomas, when he argues, he works that way. Fine, he uses the empirical to go up. When he does the proofs of the existence of God, he uses motion, he uses the intelligent design idea, all these ideas, contingency. He uses empirical things, knowing where he wants to go. So you as Catholics know where you want to go. We want to go to a natural family. We want to go to all these things, all these teachings that we have. But we've got a society with people, with audiences that are not like you, that are different. So you've got to be armed with what they know. But remember always that you're coming at it from an eagle's point of view. You're coming in above. We're getting a large picture, us. We have a history to show this. So I'm also trying to give you a large picture here, in case you haven't noticed, by citing different authors, C.S. Lewis, different professors, because we can use that. We're Catholics. We can use the others. But you have to use them with the proper principles. Guy Goulagrange, a great author from the 1940s, a spiritual theologian at the Angelicum, where I teach, he says, the liberals, so-called liberals, not, I don't even call them liberals because they're not really liberal. I'm liberal, since I want true freedom in the end. So I have an idea of liberty which is much fuller than they do. Anyway, that's another thing. They stole that word from us too. Anyway, he says they don't have good principles. Very wide principles. Everything goes. But then in the concrete, they become dictators, voluntarists. Do as I say. That's what they become. Instead, We, on the other hand, I think people who have larger vision of things, the Catholics, the ones who have been given this faith from God, we have clear principles. I think. Yeah, these are clear principles. Man and woman having children, forming a family. That's a principle. Okay? We're very clear with that. And then there's a lot of freedom in how it goes about. For instance, can you tell me that a man and woman who are not able to have children are not a family? No. They're just not able to have children. But they've married with that intention to have a family. Can you, this is another thing, this is where you have to think about this. Like, someone who marries at 60, 70, they marry a couple, that happens, you know, two widows marry. Is that marriage valid?
Yeah.
Certainly it is. But they're obviously not going to be able to have children. But the conjugal act will be conjugal act, nonetheless. So that's where it's interesting to think about these things, you know. But the principle is clear. That's marriage. That's a conjugal act. There's a unit of the procreative doesn't come out, but it maybe for some miracle, maybe she can have a child. I don't know. That could happen.
Just,
it's
about
not the first time.
And the mother of God.
Yeah, that comes up as well. That example actually comes up.
I mean, Joseph was married to Mary.
They're married, but they don't have the conjugal act.
The marriage. And yet it's a valid marriage. Whereas if you tried to do that, if you wanted to marry someone and not consummate the marriage, just for companionship, you cannot do it because it's not considered to be a valid marriage. You have to consummate it to become a valid marriage. So when I asked this of a priest once, he said to me, oh, there's a special...
I remember an answer to this one, more specific answer, I'm just forgetting it right now.
There's a special dispensation the church has given to Mary and Joseph.
Well, there is, first of all, the church was not yet founded. And I see you think like a scholastic.
In other words, you got him.
No, well, hold on. No. I had considered this question, but I just don't have an answer right now. Hold on.
Isn't there something in
there? Was an answer to this. Why on earth am I blanking out on my answer? Yes.
Isn't there something in one of the Gospels of the New Testament?
Well, I mean, no, this doesn't have to do... I know, it's... what he's saying is a typical scholastic question, query that you would put in a question in the summa.
The only reason I asked that question...
It's a good question.
Because I asked that question only because I have had experience in my own life. And that was, I was in a situation where I was wanting to marry someone who had been married and had a divorce, but couldn't get
dispensation. An annulment. Excuse me, an annulment.
And so this person wanted to marry me, and we obviously were in love. But I said, no, we cannot marry, and because of it, we cannot live in sin or outside the church. We'd have to lead a celibate life if we were to get together. We couldn't live together in celibacy. We couldn't live together, you know. But when I discussed that with the priest, couldn't we actually get married and lead a celibate marriage?
No.
Have a celibate marriage? He said, no, you can't do that. No. That's not allowed, see? But I said to him, well, why then did Mary and Joseph get away with it?
You know,
why can't we do the same? Because, you know, we love God, we want to serve God, and we don't want to sin. And because I couldn't get the annulment,
I don't have an answer for that. I don't think that's the answer, but...
Were they married?
Excuse me. Pardon?
Were they married?
Yes, they're married.
They were married before confirmation.
But they were married... Oh, wait, hold on. They were married. They were not yet married.
They were betrothed.
They were betrothed to getting married. Oh, no, I now remember the answer to this. No, yeah, they're betrothed to get married.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't want to get married to her when he finds out, right? That's the trouble.
Yeah.
But see, so
In Jewish religion, being betrothed means that you're actually married.
When you're committed.
When you're already committed.
Yeah, we have the Holy Family.
They were engaged in actual marriage. They were married. And they both promised to be virginity. But the gentleman asked the question, your situation
Bravo.
Is entirely different
That's right.
to the Joseph and Mary. And it was before the church proper, but however, they were married. And
they're married.
They were both commissioned virgins.
And the only reason why you find that this consummation thing goes on when somebody actually wants to, an annulment, they want to marry, they want to break down the marriage. So that's what I understand.
But there are couples in history, surely, who wanted to keep their virginity and be married. I thought I'd read of it in some
There were saints that did that, yeah. Yeah, I cannot believe it. I just read about this recently with an answer, and I'm sorry that I cannot recall.
I heard this canon lawyer priest said to me there was a special dispensation. The church has given a special dispensation to Mary and Joseph to have that kind of marriage.
Okay.
We do talk about the Holy Family. We do talk about them as a proper family anyhow, don't we?
They were married. All right, so there's also talking about them, talking about Our Lady. We talk about also another aspect of marriage. There are in marriage there's three goods, three ends: offspring, conjugal faith, and the sacrament itself. These are the three ends. But then there are three fruits as well: offspring, conjugal faith, and the remedium concupiscentiae. I want to focus on this: the remedy of concupiscence. Now, in the marriage of Mary, of Our Lady and Saint Joseph, there isn't a need for remedium concupiscentiae for Our Lady because she's immaculate. So they're married, but there's no read for the remedium concupiscentiae. But what is the remedium concupiscentiae? Well, what's important to understand is that marriage itself becomes a remedy, and in society, a remedy against concupiscence. What is concupiscence? Concupiscence is the concupiscible appetite. Okay, so there's two. Let me just write this down here. There's these elements that we were talking about. So you've got the faculties, the intellect, and the will. These are the faculties. And then you've got these powers. This is what we're talking about. Concupiscible, and irascible. Okay? And the concupiscible appetite is that which seeks the good. So it seeks, it moves towards the good. It's an appetite, it's a power. Appetite means to appetire, to desire something, to move towards something. And the irascible is that which moves away from the bad, from the bad. From, to the good, from the bad, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is, in Summa Theologiae, Prima Pars, question 97, when St. Thomas talks about the preternatural gifts, which are, this is what Our Lady has. You have integrity, you have impassibility, and you have immortality. These are known as the preternatural gifts. So not natural, but preternatural. Not supernatural, preternatural. Integrity means to be able to control those lower appetites. Okay? Integrity means that this and this, the intellect and the will, control these. That's what Adam and Eve had. That's what Our Lady had. So Our Lady is going to be very important in giving us integrity. When I talk about this, I use an example of Terminator 2. Terminator 3 movie, I think it's called Terminator 3. And I look at it and it's like, you think about this. So you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he's attacking, I remember that there's this robot that amalgamates constantly. So he's trying to shoot him, okay? He's trying to get him. But he has the gift of impassibility because he's metallic and he's like constantly changing, okay? So it's a nightmare because Schwarzenegger is trying to kill him. He's even immortal, it seems. You know, he's like trying to kill him, and he keeps coming back. So what's happening there is that it's a nightmare because it goes on constantly, eternally. It's the eternal return. It's hell.
Yeah,
that's hell. Because what's happening in that scene? And you see, Even the arts show these preternatural gifts. What's happening in that scene is that the will is not changing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're both wanting to kill each other. And it's never changing. The way to get rid of that wheel, that never-ending wheel, is to change the will of one of them and say, okay, basta, no, stop. All'italiana, that's what we say in Italian, basta, finito, basta, finished. Peace. Okay, just, you know, just peace, basta. And you just stop it, you know. It's like, okay, let's go have tea. Let's go have a beer. Let's go have whiskey together. And just negotiate. I'm kidding, obviously. But yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, that's not what happens in the movie. In the end. But I'm joking. I hope it makes sense what I'm joking about. But what's happening is you've got these gifts. These are the preternatural gifts. Another way that you know we have these gifts, think about it. When you have vision, the senses can be more than they are. So like when someone is deaf, his sight is better than usual. Or when someone is blind, his ear, his hearing is better. So the senses can be more than they are. Hold on. But the point is that all of these, they come back. All of this integrity, this comes back. This is what we don't have when we didn't have at the beginning with original sin. We did not, before original sin, we had integrity, impassibility, and mortality. Our Lady has integrity, impassibility, and mortality. Okay? In her marriage, too. But there are model of marriage, it's a perfect marriage, where all of this is put together. And if you think about it, these don't listen to these, the lesser powers, the emotions, the passions, they don't listen to the faculties. Why? Because the faculties aren't listening to God. So you won't listen to God? Well, we're not going to listen to you. And that's what happens. That's the disorder. That's the disorder of after original sin that you, all of us in this room face, actually, including myself. You know, I'll get really angry sometimes. I'm Italian, I get angry. But the thing is, not to let that anger get you. Right? That's the important thing. It's like, don't let that anger get you. So how do you know? So what's justified anger in Jesus? Well, when he gets in the temple. It's justified. Mm-hmm. It's the right thing to do at that moment. It's like it's the right thing to do. It's not like he goes in and starts chopping people's heads off. He just kicks them out. And he doesn't go on and on and on and on and on. He does it and it's finished. Mm-hmm. It's a just anger. But that's because he's got everything under control because he's Jesus. And so he's intellect and will controlling this. Doesn't mean you should get mad sometimes. Oh, you should also like some, you know, you should like to eat a cake or whatever. It's okay, you know, to like something that's good, that's normal. But it's the disorder that's not. So when I talk about, marriage helps the remedy of the concupiscence, basically. It remedies our problems, our confusable, obviously. You know, when you get married,